listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. President Donald Trump issued an executive order more than a week ago banning immigrants from seven largely Muslim countries from entering the United States for 90 days. People were denied access to flights, there have been massive protests, and the order has been challenged in federal court. A federal judge in Seattle made a ruling that allowed the immigrants to come into the U.S. again. The Trump administration fired back, and that led to a hearing by a federal appeals court panel last night. The panel is expected to come out with a ruling soon. If the case rules against the Trump order, it could go to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, already vetted immigrants from seven countries wait to see when they can travel to the United States. Some of them had planned to come to Siouxland. Ryan Dowelbaum is the pastor at the First Congregational Church of Christ in Sioux City. He was waiting for three people to arrive in Siouxland last weekend, but they never even got on the plane.
Up until Tuesday, we were scheduled to receive three people. Yesterday, Wednesday, a young man from Honduras whose family has been here for a while, who he hasn't seen his family in between 12 and 15 years for different members of his family. And then we were also supposed to receive a Somali mom and her young daughter. They were coming in from a refugee camp in Malaysia. And on Tuesday, those two names disappeared from the arrival page. We have an amazing immigration attorney on staff at the community house, and my understanding is that she was in touch with them just to say I'm sorry, and there's nothing we can do. She apparently, this mom had given away everything she owned in preparation to come, you know, the flight was booked, and now they're just out of luck. So it's heartbreaking, you know.
Where is she now?
She's in the camp. They didn't get on the plane. So they're still in the camp in Malaysia.
So do you have any idea what will happen to them now?
No. Implementation of the executive order has been complex and inconsistent. Even the folks who are tasked with enforcing it aren't always clear about what exactly it looks like to enforce these orders. I'm not a legal expert or an immigration expert, so I can't speak with authority on anything. But my understanding is that the president has said that after this 90-day hold, basically for 90 days, there's a complete stop. Green card applications are not being processed. Refugee applications are not being processed. Interviews are not being processed. Just a 90-day hold on everything. And then after those 90 days, the president has said that they're going to kind of look into the vetting processes that the home governments are implementing. The big problem in Somalia, which is the Siouxland community that's most impacted by this, is that in Somalia there's no real government. You know, it's pretty anarchic. Folks are at war. So documentation is really hard. I think what people don't understand is the United States already has a very thorough vetting process for everyone, the most thorough in the world, is my understanding. The people who have booked flights to come here are people who have been in this process for 2-3 years, multiple rounds of interviews, DNA testing, you know, hair samples, fecal samples, urine samples. It is thorough. And they've been waiting for years to come and to have their families reunited. And so then to be told the day before you're scheduled to get on the plane that you just can't come is really heartbreaking. And that's, I mean, frankly, as heartbreaking as that is it's not even the worst stories that I've heard. I mean, our local immigration attorneys are dealing with so much stress and trauma right now. They're talking about, you know, having to explain to mothers whose two-year-olds are, you know, in camps in Somalia or Ethiopia, I'm sorry, you know, she can't come, you can't have your two-year-old. And these moms are saying, what do you mean she's not dangerous, she's two? And our immigration attorneys have to say, I'm sorry, she's Somali, and that's what matters right now.
So when this 90 days is over, is there a chance that some of these folks will then be able to come?
Again, I'm not an expert in immigration law, and even the best immigration attorneys that I know don't know what's going on. I would hope that these people are still on record. You know, they've been through this process for so long. I would hope that after this 90 days, after the administration is assured that these are not dangerous people, and that in fact reuniting families and integrating them into the fabric of American society is the best protection against radicalization and terror that we have. I hope that once the administration starts to gain some of that assurance that some of these people might at long last get their families reunited and find refuge from the war and violence and poverty that they're seeking haven from.
Do you think the fact that this was a surprise made it harder for people? Because I often think that if people would have known a little in advance, maybe they could have rearranged their travel.
The implementation has been really bumpy. And again, my understanding is that the orders themselves were not sort of thoroughly looked at by lawyers in Washington. So both, I think, the suddenness and some of the ambiguity in the wording, you know, there was the confusion over what about green card holders. There was confusion for us initially. Well, you know, this family is Somali, but they're not coming from Somalia. They're coming from Malaysia. Does that make a difference? So I think both the suddenness and the ambiguity in the wording of the orders themselves contributes to the sense of chaos and uncertainty.
And everyone wants to feel safe.
Yep.
But it's hard sometimes to, you know, calculate the cost of that safety.
Yeah.
And who will pay.
Right. Well, and I think it's always been understood in our country that liberty and security are sometimes in tension. There are any number of illegal and unconstitutional policies that we could implement that might very well make us safer. You know, we could be a surveillance state. We could be a police state. I spent time in Spain as a college student. I studied in Madrid and had conversations with older people who remembered General Franco as the head of state there, who was a fascist dictator. And a number of those older people were like, you know, there was very little violence. The streets were clean. The trains ran on time. You know, you felt safe as long as you weren't a political dissident or, you know. So I think that's always been a tension for us in America. And I think at our best, we have always remembered that liberty is not always safe. But we, at our best, have also understood that we would rather take risks for the sake of liberty and justice for all. Even if it means that we may not always be safe. That doesn't mean that we're reckless, right? It doesn't mean that we do stupid things. It doesn't mean that we don't vet people. But I think what's really important for the community to understand is that we do vet people really thoroughly. You know, these people who are coming over, it's not like they're just kind of stumbling off the plane and we're taking every Tom, Dick, and Harry. We don't know who they are and we just sort of hand them welfare benefits. You know, it's a long, arduous process that these people have already been through. And in the meanwhile, they've been in their countries of origin, risking their lives in the midst of poverty and violence and war, or, you know, in refugee camps living in squalor.
I know that you've also been having a series of conversations about race mm-hmm. at your church. Mm-hmm. What kind of response have you gotten to that?
Overall, it's been really good. The United Church of Christ, several years ago, challenged its member churches to be engaging communities in what they call sacred conversations on race, recognizing that the history of race and racism is written deeply into the story of our nation, and that also written into that history is a history of allies of all races and cultures standing with people who are being unfairly marginalized because of their skin or national origin or religion or whatever. The curriculum was really to look at those ways that we who bear white skin have certain privileges that not all of our neighbors do, and asking questions about what it means to have those privileges with integrity and how we might be able to use those privileges to stand up for and support our neighbors of color in ways that we might not be able to if we weren't aware.
That was Ryan Dole Baum. He's the pastor of the First United Congregational Church of Christ in Sioux City. He's still waiting for word on when the immigrants who were supposed to be in Siouxland last week might be able to come to the area. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Many immigrants are having difficulties getting into the United States. However, the immigrants already here have problems as well. One of the biggest barriers is often language. Many new immigrants don't speak English, and they don't have access to a translator. The Buena Vista Regional Medical Center in Storm Lake is using new technology that helps bridge the language gap. Katie Schwint is the Director of Communications at BVRMC. She says in Storm Lake, there have been a lot of ag-related businesses that have drawn a variety of different ethnic groups to settle in the area.
We estimate that we have approximately 26 different languages or more spoken in our community. And so it's a daily occurrence where someone walks in our hospital and English is not their first language. And in a hospital setting, when you're dealing with people's health care, it can be very overwhelming, confusing information, even if English is your first language, let alone if English is not your first language. And so we really want to provide the best care for our patients, and that's what the Stratus Video Interpreting Service gives to us.
It says in the press release, basically a doctor goes to an iPad and goes to an app. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's a tablet device similar to an iPad, and it's on basically a wheeled device, so we can wheel it wherever we want in the hospital. And previously, we had more of an audio type of interpreting, or we have on-site interpreters, but people don't always let us know that they're coming, and so those interpreters would be busy or scheduled elsewhere. And so this video device, basically, we push a button like you would on any app on a tablet, and we have 19 different video languages we can choose from. We're connected in about 30 seconds, and we can position the device so the patient, the video interpreter can see the patient and the patient can see the interpreter. And then in most situations, the healthcare provider, whether that's a doctor, a nurse, a registration, somebody wanting to talk about the bill, will try to position the device so they're sitting right next to the interpreter. So the patient is basically looking at one way.
Do you also do this like with telehealth?
In telehealth situations, a lot of times that's a doctor on the actual line. These would be more just the interpreters. So they're not qualified to give actual health advice. They're just there to interpret what the healthcare provider on site is saying. But in saying that, all of these interpreters are medically trained. While they're not necessarily giving medical advice, they're trained to understand what the doctors are and then to give back that information to the patient in a very easy way for them to understand it. So, for example, a doctor may say, okay, when you go home, take an aspirin every 2 hours and drink 8 glasses of water. The interpreter can say that. They can view the patient visually to see if they understand it. And they also have a what we call a whiteboard feature where they can write on the screen so the patient can see it. And then if a patient has, like, a smartphone, they can take a picture of it and take that home in their own language.
What kind of response have you gotten from patients?
It's been overwhelmingly positive by both the patients and the staff. You know, we have worked long and hard to make all our patients feel comfortable with our interpreting services. But this adds an extra level of actually being able to see people, because most people... again, you're in healthcare situations where you're being told maybe not really good news or it's confusing, and you know, people just want to be agreeable a lot of times. With the video interpreter, they can actually see the patient, see their nonverbals, and see if they're actually understanding. And then from the caregiver side point, it just makes it a more genuine experience to be able to understand how the patient is feeling a little bit more from the interpreter's help.
I think it must also make people feel a little more welcome in a new country, in a country where they don't speak the language. And there's so much concern now about immigrants and immigrants feeling uncomfortable at times. I would assume that this might help a lot.
It does. And, you know, this goes beyond just people coming to the hospital for services in the ER. We just did an event helping educate people with mammogram services and what we can do to help those that do not have insurance. And so, for example, our mammography staff was able to have a much deeper conversation with a Vietnamese group, and they were actually asking more questions than they ever have, you know, at these health fairs we've had, just because of the interpreter services.
Wow.
And people can still schedule appointments with real live interpreters that we have on staff. This is just to add to the experience for those patients who maybe didn't book an interpreter ahead of time.
That was Katie Schwint, the Director of Communications at Buena Vista Regional Medical Center in Storm Lake. She talked about new technology that helps doctors communicate with patients who don't yet speak English. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Fear of voter fraud and the possibility of non-citizen voters is behind a move by Iowa Secretary of State's Paul Pate's measure that would require specific voter IDs at the polls. The IDs would be read by computers and verified to assure the person voting is the person listed on the voter rolls. The measure has created a lot of pushback from Democratic lawmakers who worry about the possibility of preventing low-income, non-English speakers and senior citizens from voting. The Iowa Association of County Auditors also opposes the measure, citing concerns about new technology. Daniel Zeno is a policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. He says the bill would limit voters in terms of the kinds of IDs they could use.
Right now we have a system where people can use a variety of IDs, like a student ID or an out-of-state driver's license or an employer-issued ID or their Iowa driver's license. And this system, this proposal, would limit what you can show And we know already that certain groups of people don't have the kinds of ID that the proposal requires. So African Americans, people over 65, about 15% of Iowans 65 and older don't have a photo, an ID. And so we know that this is going to disproportionately impact certain groups. And again, we have a system right now that's working. And so we think it's unnecessary. One other thing it would do is it would effectively end the same-day registration for certain voters. So the bill says you have to show an Iowa driver's license, passport, or a military ID. So for that category of voter under this proposal, they would be able to register on election day and vote. If you do not have one of those three IDs, then you would have to get one of the free cards that the secretary, that the state would issue to you. But to get the free card, you have to pre-register 11 days before the election. So in other words, if you miss that 11-day pre-registration deadline and you go to the poll on election day and you say, I want to register, but you don't have an ID, one of those three, Iowa driver's license, a passport, or a military ID, then there's no way for you to get the free card that day. So you can't, there's no same-day registration for that group of people. And that is a dramatic change from what Iowa law is right now.
I know that part of this issue has to do with access. Part of it also has to do with cost. There doesn't seem to be a lot of money for many programs, and people have been concerned about coming up with another $1 million to try and put this into counties all over Iowa.
So part of the cost for the secretary's proposal is about the electronic poll book, but part of it is also about providing those free cards. And the number that the Secretary of State has come up with, we think, is an underestimate. So what the Secretary of State did to come up with the number of people who would need the ID is he looked at the people who are already registered and then cross-checked that with DOT data to see who doesn't have an ID. So that's an underestimate because there are people who are eligible to vote who aren't registered yet, right? And so none of those people were counted in the secretary's calculation. So that's one part of an underestimate. Another is, the cost of outreach, the cost of letting people know this is the new way we're going to do elections in Iowa. And the secretary has said that, they're sort of going to roll it into their current budget. But this is a dramatic change. This will require every Iowan to do something different when they go to the polls.
I was reading about some of the reactions of the county level elections officials who really were concerned not only about the money, but they were also concerned because from what they had heard before this election, that the Iowa election system was in really good shape. So they were wondering what had changed.
The Secretary of State in October, I believe October of 2016, came out and publicly said, we have a good system. In January, I think it was January 5th, when the Secretary had his press conference announcing this proposal, he again said, we have a good system. And he's continued to say that we have a good system. And there's no evidence that there's any fraud or abuse happening right now. And so we have the same question, that we have a good system. There's no evidence anything's wrong. And so we don't know why this is necessary.
Daniel Zeno is a policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. He was describing some of the possible issues that could arise from Secretary of State Paul Pate's bill that requires new IDs and other changes for Iowa voters. Pate was contacted for an interview, but so far hasn't been able to schedule one. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While voting rights is a big issue at the State House at the moment, state workers have their problems as well. They've had their fears about their rights to collective bargaining confirmed. Yesterday, Republican lawmakers came out with a plan
that was prompted by Governor Terry Branstad that would change the benefits of the public worker pension plan and require one health insurance plan for most state workers. It also decimates the collective bargaining system that has been in place for decades. Workers held a series of news conferences about the rumored changes in the state last week. One was held in Sioux City. Teacher Amy DeGroote Hammer speaks first, and then Woodbury County Sheriff Dan Drew.
We are gathered together as part of six other press conferences around the state, all of us carrying a message to legislators at the state capitol who have shut their doors to the more than 180,000 public sector workers who will be affected by the proposed changes to Iowa's collective bargaining laws. So far, all we have heard are rumors about what is going to be done to us. Legislators have not spoken with any of us who sit at the bargaining tables and negotiate the contracts that have worked well and kept us in good standing for more than 40 years. Not one of us can recall an election year that proposed changes to our bargaining laws or a rallying cry from the public that demanded public employees' rights be stripped. So it leaves us to wonder why state legislators have decided to play politics behind closed doors with the men and women who are the backbone of Iowa's frontline workforce, including police officers, firefighters, correction officers, our public school teachers, our nurses, our road safety crews, and electric utility line workers, sanitation crews, and all sorts of jobs and professions that keep the public safe, healthy, and economically sound. Today you will hear from the men and women who will be affected by the officials who will not speak or listen to us. And now I'd like to introduce Dave Drew, who is our sheriff of Woodbury County. Dave, please welcome Dave.
I just want to share a few thoughts of 36 years of public sector employment. I have enjoyed the work, and most of that has been, I would say 32 years of that, on the side of bargaining and trying to get wages. The last four on the other side. What I want to share with you is experience of management side. I read in the Duane paper, a legislator or someone made a comment, it gets bogged down with too many grievances. Well, that's a management issue. You need to learn how to work with your employees. The CWA union that I'm a part of, or that I was and I still consider myself, we have worked together to make any adjustments that were needed because we are working together. And as Iowans, as public sector employees, that's what we do. I appreciate teachers. I used to teach DARE. I knew how they were in the classroom. Firefighters, tough job, police officers, everybody that's involved in this that is a public sector employee. My wife has been a employee for the state of Iowa Department of Human Services for 34 years. And so we are part of that. It's been our family. It's been something that we do. But to strip away these rights or take away these things, I'm not quite sure why. We work together. Don't take away what has worked for Iowans. I appreciate your all being here today because I want you to know, as somebody now that's supposedly on the other side, I support you and I stand with you. So thank you.
That was teacher Amy DeGroote Hammer and Woodbury County Sheriff Dave Drew. They spoke at a press conference given by state workers, one of many throughout the state last week. The measure that would change state workers' bargaining rights and their benefits is now before lawmakers. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, many state workers and many in state government and agencies and nonprofits are concerned about the effects of Iowa's big budget deficit. Some say the state shouldn't have been put in this position in the first place to have over $100 million deficit. Some Democratic state lawmakers say tax cuts by Governor Branstad 4 years ago set up the state for a financial fall. But Branstad supporters say state revenues were nowhere near as high as predicted, and that's why there was such a big deficit. Siouxland Democratic Representative Chris Hall says that Governor Branstad and Republicans were just too aggressive in pursuing tax cuts and other program changes.
I've served on the Appropriations Committee for 6 years, each year that I've been in the legislature. And watching the budget process unfold over the past years has really been a good experience, and I think it's taught me some lessons. 4 years ago, people might not recall, but the state was doing very well climbing out of the recession, and we had a budget surplus of about $800 million. That $800 million was on top of our rainy day funds being full. So altogether, the state had a surplus and rainy day accounts of over $1 billion, probably closer to $1.5 billion. The $800 million has been eaten down so significantly that there is probably only about $40 or $50 million left in it this year. And that surplus is very useful in absorbing budget years where either revenue doesn't come in as strongly as expected, or it helps to absorb bringing large programs online. My judgment as to why this budget shortfall is so huge is that the legislature, and especially legislative Republicans and the governor, were far too aggressive in pursuing some big program changes. When we had $800 million in the surplus, things looked very good, and I think they were too ambitious. They took on commercial property tax cut that has cost the state roughly $400 million each year now. They also did some education reforms, which cost a total of about $250 million each year. The governor privatized Medicaid this past spring without any legislative approval. And doing so, he has now come back and said that we need to increase payment to these private companies by another $21 million. So if you add all of these big expenses up and you take them each year where state revenues are not coming in as strongly as expected, but the state is spending more on big reforms that the Republicans really pushed, we're not able to have both of those ends connect and expect that the budget's going to balance. And I think that the governor in particular could have done a better job at looking at the fact the past six revenue estimating meetings, they have decreased their estimates. They have decreased what the state was expected to take in each of the last six meetings that happen, and those happen three times a year. The governor has not trimmed his spending or offered guidance as to what needed to be trimmed early so that it wouldn't completely eat away our surplus and actually put us in the red midway into a budget year.
Is that something that, you know, we expect the governor to be doing looking ahead?
It ought to be led by the governor, yes. I think it's cooperative in form. In getting any budget passed, you have to have legislative leaders and the governor's office engaged. But the governor has two of the three members of our revenue estimating conference are appointees of the governor. This is a process that comes from the executive branch, and most Iowans, I think, expect the executive of the state to be the one who is managing the budget. If we've seen significant shortfalls or decreased revenue, he should have his thumb on the pulse of what's happening in these budget meetings, and I think he should have offered a little bit more guidance some time ago.
That was Chris Hall. He's the 13th District Democratic Representative from Sioux City. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While many large parts of state governments have seen some cuts in the past few weeks, some of the smaller areas were also affected. This is especially true of the arts. Lawmakers cut the Iowa Council for the Arts and removed nearly all of the money from the Iowa Cultural Trust, which had been about $6 million. Sioux City Public Museum Director Steve Hansen is a former state senator from Sioux City. He says that it's unfortunate that the trust was raided at a time when it was really starting to make a difference in some communities.
Especially in smaller communities, it doesn't take much to make a big difference. And so I kind of rue that. I mean, for us, we only tapped into the cultural trust once. But certainly we were looking to do it again if we saw the opportunity. And there's even a larger thing going on. It's just not the cultural trust that got diminished or swiped, you know, $6 million plus. But the Department of Cultural Affairs also has to take a pretty substantial cut, over $250,000 between now and the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, that creates an amount of upheaval. And so, once again, the department head, Mary County, is going to have to, what's she going to do? Is she going to cut staff? Will she cut programs? My guess is what happens. She'll cut programs and assume that she's going to get fully funded.
You talk about like smaller communities. I know like up around the Iowa Lakes area, they have many smaller museums, small art galleries that have benefited quite a lot from this money and from this fund. They got small amounts of money. They were able to match it with local money, and it made a huge difference for them up there.
Well, it does. I presented a workshop this last Monday up in Primgar, and it was mostly to smaller facilities. Well, they're all smaller facilities that many of them operate on volunteers, and they were talking about the lack of resources. And, you know, every once in a while you're reminded, because we were talking about, you know, in Sioux City where fifth graders go to the art center and fourth graders, you know, come to the museum. And one of the participants says, well, we don't have a school in our town. So that makes it a little bit more difficult. And, you know, it's that little reality check. Oh, yeah, you know. So now you got the added resource of bringing them in from farther away. And to get them to come, you need resources to provide programming and other items. And, if there was a certain feeling of left behindness in the last election, it's kind of events like this that create an even larger divide. So hopefully... What I found lacking from the legislature, I didn't hear anybody say on the trust funds that were taken from it, wasn't just the Department of Cultural Affairs Trust Fund, there were some others. I didn't hear any promise to come back and backfill those in moving forward, and that's troubling. I was in legislature at one time during the farm crisis, and we had to take from some trust funds, and that was a very difficult decision, but there was no place to go. There were no rainy day funds at that time, no emergency funds. Those were a product of the farm crisis, and we came up with those so you could avoid situations like this. But when we did take that money, we did say, you know, we're committed to replacing those funds. It'd be like taking the Social Security money, you know, and just saying, now we're not going to pay it back. It really does open up a whole scenario of who can you trust? And that's unfortunate, because public's level of trust right now in government isn't particularly high. And these kind of incidents just, you know, eroded even more.
And the museum and other organizations around the city, I mean, there are all these things that happen through these organizations that help people feel less isolated and get along with each other. And to me, that's part of the problem when the funding is gone.
Well, and, you know, when we were looking to build the museum downtown, one of my hopes was that we could expand our audience, expand our programming. What I think a lot of people don't realize, we are a city facility, and we enjoy a pretty steady funding stream. But if you look at our city budget, it doesn't have a line item in there for education or exhibits. So my association raises money, and we do seek out grants and other funding sources. So the Department of Cultural Affairs, foundations, whatever it might be, that's how we expand our program. And we've made a dedicated effort, as you mentioned, a couple, whether it's Day of the Dead programs or the Hmong Textile, right on down the line, of trying to reach out and bring more people in from the community and from the surrounding communities. So those extra funds do come in handy.
So what do you see the next year looking like without that money? I mean, do you think it's going to make a big difference in your decision-making?
Well, truthfully, I don't think it will for us. We're in a position where we have other sources. But I do think throughout the state, and as we spoke about those smaller communities, they have a limited donor pool. They have severely more limited resources to draw from. And right when the time where the Department of Cultural Affairs was actually starting to have more of an impact, now it's going to go backwards. So, the thing is, the pendulum always swings, but budgeting, whether it's in your own home or it's local government, whatever level you're at, budgeting is about priority setting. And right now, the priorities clearly are not about the Department of Cultural Affairs. So that's, for me, that's unsettling.
Steve Hansen is the director of the Sioux City Public Museum and a former state lawmaker. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. David Johnson is a current state senator from Ochiden in northwest Iowa. Johnson used to be a Republican, but he became an independent this summer when he said he couldn't support now President Donald Trump as the party's nominee. Johnson spoke out against the cuts in the arts and cultural affairs on the floor of the Iowa Senate a few weeks ago. He says that small cities and towns with arts organizations really need the extra financial help that they get from the state, and that grants are usually given out to very deserving organizations.
Especially at a time when, you know, there seems to be a lack of public support for the arts and cultural activities. I mean, this isn't just about arts; it's about museums and a lot of other cultural attractions. I represent five counties in northwest Iowa. Two of them, Clay and Dickinson, they have been able to get grants totaling $60,000 over the period since the trust was established. And this is a trust that's not protected, you know, it's not provided for under the Constitution. So, it's subject to being what we say raided and just taken for other purposes, not for what it's intended to be. But that has leveraged at least $180,000 in other matching funds. And even beyond that, another $500,000 in philanthropic donations to programs. It's not a good thing to see these kind of programs cut. I don't think there's a real understanding of the role that music and art can play in our schools. There's definitely a connection between music and art, and also being more successful in learning science and math, or those are the kind of studies that we would like to encourage students to do. It just sends an overall bad message, I believe.
I know that organizations and, smaller areas up there like the Pearson Lakes Art Center and in Orange City, I know that they benefit quite a bit from state money.
The thing is, the grants are like seeds that are planted, and then you get some support for that to help that money grow even more. I mean, it's to leverage additional money, and so everybody's got a buy-in into it. We do have, we have a really interesting opportunity to open up a new state park up there, which I know the Lyon County Historical Society, and it would be the first two-state park in the nation. I mean, we'd share that with South Dakota, and it's just rich with artifacts from the Native American tribes that populated that place in very large numbers. Whether that would perhaps some of the cultural trust could have been used, there could have been applications to help us get even more interpretation out of that site. It's a sacred burial and ceremonial site, especially for the Oneota tribe, but also other tribes. Some people just think, we can just put art on the shelf and the state doesn't have to participate in that. But it goes beyond that. It goes into museums and preserving pieces of our history. So, I know that budget times are tight, but this money was specifically earmarked for arts and cultural purposes.
That was David Johnson, an independent state senator from the 1st District in Ochiden in northwest Iowa. He's hoping that he and some other lawmakers will be able to add in some money that could help rebuild the Iowa Cultural Trust. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Orange City Arts is a group that helps promote and facilitate the arts and culture in Orange City and the surrounding area. Janine Kalspeak is the executive director of the organization. She says that Orange City Arts has benefited from grants from the Iowa Cultural Trust and also from the Iowa Arts Council. She says without the grants, Orange City might need some extra help.
It might be true, yeah, because we have small budgets to start with. If we can't get a grant, then we just may have to limit the amount of things we do, which is frustrating because we're trying to provide a better quality of life for the people in the area. And the arts make for a better quality of life. So it's sort of is making the state's goal of making this a great state with great quality of life and a vibrancy in our state. Yeah, it's working against that, unfortunately.
How have you used some of those grants?
You know, we did use the grant money from the Iowa Arts Council for Arts on Central a couple of years ago. That started our outdoor festival, interactive festival of arts. And we even had some Sioux City artists come up. And just that $4,000 helped us get something new started. It's a free event, so that was very helpful to us. We're trying to keep that going. Hopefully we'll be able to. Yeah, we did it last year.
So do you think it will work out for you financially?
Orange City's more prosperous than a lot of little towns. And so, you know, something that we can probably continue, other little towns won't be able to. Some of the grants we've received, it's exciting because the Iowa Arts Council requires us to involve the community and not just have one program, but have outreach activities for schools and such. And so we have included several local towns, several area towns, and schools from area towns in our outreach activities. So one of the teachers last fall said, oh, we don't have a very good arts program in our school. So it was so exciting to come to the performance, the assembly, school assembly for Artrageous. She was so excited to see her children up there on the stage participating with the group. And she already had kids ask if they could come again next year. So that teacher was so excited. And this was from a smaller school from the area. So it's a great thing, these little grants from Iowa Arts Council.
That was Janet Kalspeak, the executive director of Orange City Arts. She says she's benefited from the grants the organization has from the Iowa Cultural Trust and the Iowa Arts Council. She's not sure if the state cuts in arts funding will affect them just yet. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Next week, we'll talk with the CEO and president of Ho-Chunk, Lance Morgan. Morgan says he's pushing to help his tribe, the Winnebago, be self-sufficient, and also to help grow downtown Sioux City. Thanks today to Mark Munger, Steve Smith, and Rick Turner. We will see you next Wednesday.